Welcome back. On this day in history, Wednesday, July 17th, this is the day in 1911 that Frank Snowden was born. And he's nothing to do with the Snowden who's now releasing the NSA tapes. No, Frank Snowden is somebody we really should remember. He was a foremost scholar on Africans in ancient history, blacks in antiquity, Ethiopians in the Greco-Roman experience, and before color prejudice, the ancient view of blacks. Incredible works that were written in the early part of the 20th century. In 1942 on this day, Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr., Muhammad Ali, was born, and he certainly transformed society in many ways. And this is a day in 1944 when an ammunition dump exploded in Chicago, Port Chicago, California, I should say. 320 men died. 202 African Americans assigned to Navy to handle explosives. This was a time when black men in the services were given the most dangerous functions on the dock. And they struck, and they said, no more work unless you have more safety. And it led to the conviction of 50 men, became known as the Port Chicago Mutiny, a piece of our history you should investigate and know. This is also the day that, in 1959, that Billie Holiday died at only the age of 44. It's also the day in 1967, the great John Coltrane passed away. And that's it for today in history. Robert McChesney, Bob McChesney, is the Gutskell Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. He's written a number of books like Rich Media, Poor Democracy, and Communication Revolution. And his latest book is Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And Bob McChesney, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Mark.
Two times and twice in a month. This is interesting. You've been on the show, which is good.
We'll have to keep doing this.
Make a habit of it. But let's start. One of the things I think that is a good place to begin with this book about the digital disconnect in America is your subtitle. Because I think that really says it all, is how capitalism has turned the internet against democracy. And you spend a great deal of time all through the book, but especially in the beginning of the book, kind of defining what you mean by capitalism and even kind of creating some new sense of what that means when you talk about really existing capitalism. But talk about why you took this notion, this really overwhelming idea we have in our cultures around the digitalization of our economy and our world, but began with an analysis of how capitalism affects not just that, but all of us.
Well, one of the problems, Mark, that I had with a lot of the books that have come from the Internet, and it's really become a cottage industry, is that they exaggerated the importance of technology. So technology sort of was ahistorical and rose upshot over society and created the world on its own. And the people who were critical of the Internet did this. Technology was the boogeyman. And then the people who were celebrating the digital revolution, technology solved all our problems. And in both cases, I thought there was a fundamental flaw that this really didn't do a very good job of explaining the interaction of technology with our existing society. And my sense was, from studying the Internet now for 20 years and studying communication, is that capitalism has had more influence over technology and the Internet than the Internet has had over capitalism. And that the missing ingredient to really making sense of the digital revolution, to making sense of where the Internet is going, how it operates, what the real issues are concerning it. What was missing was really understanding how capitalism works in our society, the dominant role it plays in shaping our social lives, and how it's very much domesticated the Internet. So that was the whole premise of the book, that that's what's needed, that's what's missing. And then when I did that, there was really what I would say is an accurate understanding of how capitalism actually works in the real world. I lay out in the book. And then there's also what I call really existing, which I call really existing capitalism. And then there's also what I call the catechism, which is sort of the rhetoric we have of our economy that we hear politicians talk about and pundits, but that's only loosely related to the really existing capitalism that Americans experience. So for me to make my argument in the book, I've got to pretty much lay out, you know, what capitalism actually looks like, and what the baloney is that we hear about through that, so we can make sense of the relationship of really existing capitalism to the Internet.
But you talk about how both the celebrants of this the digital world and its skeptics lack a political economic context.
Yeah, I think they both buy into the mythology that capitalism is more or less made up of entrepreneurs competing in free markets, and they're innovating, and the system left to its own devices will largely work. Maybe there's some place for government to help out and intervene and patch up the rough patches, but basically it's the best of all possible worlds. Now, the celebrants who really think the Internet's, you know, making the world fantastic, some of them are quite critical of capitalism as it exists, but they're confident that the Internet can create a new capitalism that's going to have friendly, eco-friendly corporations, and everyone's going to have a job with great pay, and democracy is going to work better. So they're confident that whatever the problems are, they acknowledge in capitalism, they will be short-lived thanks to the Internet. And again, you know, the evidence for this is non-existent. It's all assertion. It's all hyperbole. If we look at the actual record of capitalism in the United States and the real data, the economics, we have a very different picture than the catechism gives us, than the sort of the celebrants of technology and the critics of technology give us. Capitalism, you know, for starters, is a system that's based on extreme inequality and growing inequality. And this is one of the core problems capitalism has with democracy, because democracy is based on political equality. And this has been a running tension between having a capitalist economy and having a political democracy throughout American history. And it's really accelerated in the last 125 years, the emergence of sort of modern corporate-based capitalism. This tension has not been eliminated by the Internet. This tension has not diminished in the last 20 years of the World Wide Web. If anything, it has accelerated. Now, I'm not arguing the Internet caused that, because I don't think that you can put that on the Internet. I think that's how capitalism works. I do think it's clear that the Internet hasn't done anything to alleviate the problem or turn it in a different direction. And anyone who's serious about talking about the Internet as a democratizing agency has got to come to terms with that relationship, that we can't have an increasingly democratic society thanks to the Internet if economic inequality is growing sharply. That those two things can't be reconciled.
But as you write about it, and as you put in early in your book, you talk about the ABCs of the political economy of communications, or PEC as you put it, and that what you're doing here in some ways, beginning here and throughout the book, is tracing this lineage of the beginning of the Internet and then kind of showing how different arguments politically have changed the nature of who actually can control and own it. I mean, I remember when we started doing, you write about this in the book, about ISPs, the Internet Service Providers, when we started this radio show in the early 90s, there were a lot of local, small Internet service providers, like in this local area here, places like CharmNet, ToadNet, and others, that actually are the ones who gave us our cell phone service, gave us our Internet service. They used to underwrite this show as local companies to provide the service to the people and compete against one another but really worked at building and wanted to see an infrastructure built in Baltimore. There was a big battle that they helped, that they fought, that we were all part of, to kind of open this kind of infrastructure in Baltimore that would be open for pipes for the Internet that lost. But you don't even hear about Internet service providers anymore as independent companies. I mean, in the last 30 years, it's gone, 20 years.
Well, I think that is a key chapter in the book, is where I talk about how Internet service provision has become a monopoly undertaking in the United States. It's really not even a monopoly. It's a cartel. There are only three or four companies that have divided up the market. And so Americans pay vastly higher prices for grossly inferior service to Europeans. And since you're like myself, and maybe yourself, Mark, or some of the listeners, if you travel to Europe or East Asia, and you see the quality of service at the price people pay in Europe or in Japan or Korea, you're always astounded at how much better the service is at a much lower price. And it's largely because one of the truths about capitalism I get at in the book is that this notion of there's an independent free market with all this competition that produces low prices and the highest possible product, that's really the textbook version. The real world version of capitalism, as it really exists in America, is the government plays a central role in the whole process. And this is particularly true of anything with communication and communication technology. The Internet was completely bankrolled by the government for the first few decades it was developed, into the 1990s. It was a government subsidy. The government tried to give it to AT&T, the predecessor of their net in the 70s, and AT&T turned it down because it couldn't figure out how to make money off the darn thing. And it's really a testament to public investment. And it's only in the 90s that it becomes commercialized, and I chronicle that in the book. And here it's where the corrupt policymaking comes into play. And the real world of capitalism is about the government playing a crucial role in doling out licenses, monopolies, tax breaks, all sorts of goodies in a very corrupt manner to powerful interests with very little public involvement. And that's the corrupting influence of capitalism over democratic governance. And nowhere, Mark, is this more clear in the Internet than with what has happened with Internet service provision. You're absolutely right. Back in the 1990s, there were hundreds of little mom-and-pop companies that were ISPs, and they were able to exist because we had a strict telecommunication requirement saying that phone companies had to allow ISPs to use their wires at the exact same rate as each other and that they couldn't be undercut by the phone company itself. So we had a highly competitive market with all these small firms. Well, you can imagine the phone companies didn't think that was such a great deal. They had these lovely wires, and they had to share them. Likewise, the cable companies, when cable modem came along, they didn't like the idea that they, too, would have to share their cable wires with all sorts of competitive companies that would use them to compete to give a better service. So very quietly, with virtually no public debate discussion, the Federal Communications Commission basically said to the cable companies and then the phone companies, you can basically not let anyone else use your wires. You can have a monopoly control over Internet access versus your wires. And the criminality of this, and I'm using that strong word because it really is criminal, is that the phone and cable companies only exist in the first place because they were given monopoly licenses by the government, monopoly franchises. These were never competitive companies that won out in any sort of marketplace. They're always monopoly franchises. And so then the government creates these monopolies and now says in this new Internet era, we're going to let you maintain your monopoly and even become more concentrated and more powerful. And as a result, what we have in America is exactly what an economist would tell you would get. We have much higher prices and much crappier service than other countries. In the year 2000, Mark, the United States was in the top one, two, or three in virtually every standard, every measure of Internet speed, access, expense, cost to consumers. I mean, we were the envy of the world in many respects 13 or 14 years ago. Today, depending on what the measure is, we rank at best between 15 and 20, oftentimes now we're between 20 and 30, and we're falling. And it's all because of the extraordinarily corrupt way that the system has developed in the United States.
And one of the things that I think was kind of so insidious about it, and you write about this, in your chapter called Where the Dinosaurs Roam, which I think is important, is that when we debated this on the air here, when it did change, and it was when the United States allowed, as we were talking about, allowed cable companies to be services, information services, and change the whole nature of what they do and what they can do. They were kind of no longer. Being these communications devices, their own information services, so they could monopolize it. And it went from, so the entire industry can control what they wanted to and keep everybody else out.
Well, this is really, you've gotten it. It's such an important point, and it's somewhat in the weeds, but it's really worth saying out so listeners can understand how policy works on this crucial issue. Cable companies, like telephone companies, were telecommunication companies prior to 2002, meaning they have the exact same telecommunication regulations and public interest requirements. In 2002, what the Federal Communications Commission did in a 4-to-1 vote, Bill Kotz being the one dissenter, or 3-to-1, because there were only four members at the time, what the FCC did is that it reclassified cable information service from a telecommunication provider. And that reclassification meant that, therefore, the traditional telecommunication regulations no longer applied, and they could set up this monopoly service. Now, this was done arbitrarily by the FCC. This is a gift to the cable industry. There's no debate, no discussion, no press coverage. It was as secret as anything could possibly be. And, of course, shortly thereafter, the telephone companies said, hey, if they can do it, why can't we? That's unfair competition. And they had a good point at that level. So they were entitled to do the same thing with their broadband services as they were developed. But again, it was done completely corruptly. Now, it's worth noting, and I'm not suggesting a conspiracy, but the people who voted allowed the cable company to have this monopoly franchise and eliminate competition. They left the FCC. Almost all of them go on to very lucrative careers in industry as lobbyists and executives. This is where that corrupt circle can be seen.
And I agree. I mean, I think that we make a mistake of calling it a conspiracy because it sets it outside of the reality of what happens in the world of the political economy of the United States, because it's not so much conspiracy as it is the way this system functions and the way it has really come to function over the last 40 years, and especially after the last 20 years of this kind of dangerous kind of intersection of the rise of kind of these, they're not monopolies, you used a better word a moment ago than monopolies, these kind of oligarchies in one sense, and the rise of the secret government together has created this world. I mean, because of the power speaks to each other, and they meld into one another and change roles back.
And I mean, the lesson I tried to make in the book is that the way the Internet is developing today is nothing natural, inevitable, or organic about it. It's very much the result of crucial policies, just like the ones we've been talking about, that allowed the cable and phone companies to establish monopoly control over their wives, and a national cartel where they divvied up Internet access around the country so that most Americans really only have one or two choices. I mean, our cell phone service, our smartphone service is ridiculous, the lack of choice and the high prices we pay for such crummy service. And these are policies that can be changed. I mean, these are policies that we could have a very different Internet overnight with just a handful of policy changes. The reason why we aren't having those changes aren't likely is that there's very little public recognition of these debates and these policies, and there's tremendous commercial pressure to maintain the status quo. But there's nothing about that that's written into the nature of this technology that requires what we have, quite the opposite.
I mean, as you're right, you know, the United States ranks 26th in the average consumer download speed, and I think one study has talked about global cities that we pay higher prices than anybody else for these poor performance, and that is the case. I mean, I think most Americans think that the price we pay on our monthly bills for cable, for our internet service, for our cell phones is just a natural way of things.
Well, that's what the companies want you to think, and as long as you think that, you won't do anything about it.
So, going back to the whole question of how this political economy worked and how this functioned, there's a thing you talk about in the end of the book, which I would like to jump ahead of and come back to, because I really never heard of it before, and it was really fascinating to me about how this really functions. And it's called the Lauderdale Paradox. I never heard of this before. Please explain that to us and what this has to do with our digital revolution.
Lauderdale was an economist a couple hundred years ago from the great era of Adam Smith and Ricardo and John Stuart Mill, who was trying to come to grips with how capitalism is changing the world and the sort of the effort to make money 200 years ago with this, what everyone at the time understood was a radically different type of economy than humanity had ever had before. And Lauderdale was trying to wrestle with the fact that he saw people trying to make money doing stuff that didn't seem very good for society, but by economic theory at the time, it was good. If someone made money and made profit, and you know, then it was by definition good because they were increasing the output of the economy. So what Lauderdale said, well, maybe there's a paradox here that the more money that is made can actually lead to an overall diminishment in the wealth of a society. And he used this in terms of the privatization of water and land, which made individuals rich, especially in land then, but he used the example of water that would be put on private property and then given access by private owners. But, you know, someone would get rich by privatizing land or water, but society as a whole would lose. The people would no longer then have easy access to water. So while someone got rich, there was a cost that the economy couldn't factor in. Environmentalists have used this paradox a lot. It's come back. It's in vogue now the last 10 or 15 years to explain how a society that can grow rapidly can actually be getting much poorer because it has all sorts of unaccountable costs, the damage done to the environment in particular by economic development. So a country like China, we talk about its extraordinary economic growth rate of the last 20 or 30 years, and it is amazing by any standard. But when you factor in the cost of the environment that's been created by that rapid growth, then it's a much smaller growth rate. And some would argue almost a negative growth rate in terms of the quality of life for people living there. So I applied that, and I think that's a good way to look at the Internet, that, you know, the Internet has developed, but as we've privatized it, as we've created surveillance of everybody, as we've commercialized it, as we put up toll booths everywhere, we've lost sort of the commons. And, you know, so though someone's getting rich, and I chronicle in the book there are a handful of corporations that have gotten spectacularly rich online.
Right.
I'm not sure it's made the quality of our lives that much richer than they would have been otherwise.
I mean, as you're right, I mean, this is where... this is where the GDP, as you write, can soar, creating these digital fiefdoms, but it doesn't do anything for the public will or the public or public wealth at all.
You know, in the book, in the key chapter in the book, I chronicle, and I think this is sort of original work that is just starting to get out. You know, this mythology of capitalism is of the free market and all this competition. And I think in the Internet, we're told more than anywhere else is going to be the champion of competition because it's going to give consumers all sorts of information and choices. So goodbye to those dinosaur monopolies that
right.
used to have all the power over us. And I think one of the paradoxes that I chronicle in the book, one of the ironies, is that the Internet, instead of being a champion of competition, might be the greatest enabler of monopoly in the economic sense of the term. In the history of capitalism, if not of all economies, because everywhere you look online in the Internet, what you have are gigantic companies that have monopoly power over crucial markets, and they completely dominate the Internet. Today, for example, Mark, 12 of the 30 most valuable companies in the United States are all Internet companies. They're all monopolies, basically. You know, they're either AT&T, Verizon, or Comcast, that have monopoly ISPs, so they're Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, eBay, Oracle, that have key monopolies over fundamental aspects of Internet economics. And it's really astonishing the sort of the size of these gigantic firms and the power they have and the lack of competition. And when I say monopolies, I use it in the terms economists use the term monopoly. When economists says monopoly, they don't mean a company has 100% of control of the market the product in. What they mean is the company has control, usually over 50%, that they can pretty much set the price and determine how other entrants there are. If it's of an interest to them to rub someone out, they can keep lowering the price to bump them out, then they raise the price back up again. John D. Rockefeller with Standard Oil did not have 100% of the oil market. I think he had mostly around 80, 85%. But it was enough, basically, to have complete control over the oil market in the United States. That's how it is with these Internet monopolies, Microsoft, Google, Apple, Amazon. They don't have 100% of the market, but they've got, in their core money-making market, they usually have between 70 and 80, 85%. Oftentimes, they have a higher percentage than John D. Rockefeller had with Standard Oil. They have enough that they really control the market completely, and they make these monopoly profits there, and they use those profits then to buy other companies, to seize other markets, to make sure there won't be any new competitors coming up to challenge them. And the world of the Internet economy now that dominates modern capitalism is one of these massive empires that are really contending with each other for control over the Internet.
And you likened it, there are two things I want to get here before we get to break, if we can. If not, we'll do it when we come back from break. But one of them is you liken these gigantic corporations and what they control in terms of our digital world to continents.
I'm sorry to say that again. To continents, yes. I mean, I think the way to understand Google, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Verizon, AT&T is they're like giant continents trying to battle for world dominance. So they have their home empire where they make their monopoly profits, each of them, where they make lots of money. And then they use their monopoly profits to strike out and try to get new ventures to make inroads into their opponent's territory and to fortify their own borders. And basically, these are the only players. And if you don't have a monopoly franchise online, then you're sort of on a small island and you're easily crushed. And this is the nature of the world today. Each of them is trying to be all things to all people. That's the ambition is. So if you look at the news, you all see this, read the business section or read Business Week magazine or The Economist for like 3 or 4 weeks. And what you'll notice instantly is that all those companies I just named, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, Google. They're all doing smartphones. They're all working on search. They're all going into each other's territory. They all want to basically be a company store for everything online to collect data on you. And so it's really, that's the world they're constructing. That's the level of competition they have. And it's a level that allows very, very little room for small enterprise. I mean, again, the magnitude of these companies, 12 of the 30 largest in the American economy, I think, the too big to fail banks, only 3 of the 30 are banks. The energy companies that own our government and set the environmental policy, the only 2 or 3 oil companies. we're talking about really an order of magnitude here of who runs our political economy. And with that, that means an order of magnitude of who's going to be running our government when any policies come along that affect the internet.
That, and as you point out, we'll get to this right after the break, but as you point out was it Gates or somebody, Google, I think you say in the book, said that they could never have started the company in the atmosphere today as they did before.
Absolutely. This is something that is recognized, that one of the points of becoming a giant is to make sure you can limit competition. And the age of companies coming up and hitting it big and getting becoming autonomous giants is rapidly ending, if it isn't over. Today, your best bet is to start a company, have a good idea, and then hope one of the giants gives you a few $100 million to buy you out, and you cash in your chips and move to the Caribbean. But the idea that you're going to actually make it all the way to the end and go toe-to-toe with Google and Microsoft, it may still happen. I mean, I can't rule out completely, but I do think that even the people involved in the industry understand that's far less likely, not only because of the existing market power of the giants, but because of what patent law does. Today, if you're trying to start something, you might have a year or two of just doing patent wars because everything's been patented by the giants. So it's virtually impossible to start something without having to send a team of lawyers into court to clear your path.
We're talking with Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, about his new book, Digital Disconnect: How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We continue our conversation about the digital disconnect, how capitalism is turning the internet against democracy, by our guest, Robert McChesney, who's professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Bob, one of this is so the order of the day in many ways is this kind of oligarchic capitalism has kind of stranglehold on our lives in America. But one of the things that I think that you really outline in great detail that is one of the most frightening aspects of this, at least for the future of democracy, before we talk about journalism, is the intersection between industry and government, between how the humble beginnings of the internet and these engines in the government and the rise of these companies, the interchange of information. This is where we're battling with right now in America. People are becoming aware of it. But this is one of the most dangerous aspects of it all that I think people just don't know. They throw their hands up going, where did it come from? How did it start? I can't do anything about it.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, Mark, because when I wrote the book, I really wanted to end up at that point so people could see the various layers that put us at a point today where we have very large corporations and the government working hand in hand, joined at the hip. And it really undermines the ludicrous notion that the government is somehow this hostile force to free enterprise, or, the sort of the catechism mumbo-jumbo politicians tell us. That is just ridiculous when you look at the actual record of how the government works hand in hand with these companies. One of the layers that's important to understand this relationship is that advertising, big companies selling their products to increase their market share, protect their market share, is a crucial part of modern capitalism. It's in the bone marrow of it. And it was worked incessantly to find ways to cultivate the internet to become an advertising medium. When the internet first came along in the 90s, I mean, advertisers and corporations were freaked out. They had no idea how they were going to get people to succumb to advertising online. The old days of just forcing people to watch TV ads 40 times so the slogan was hammered into someone's head were over. No one was going to sit through ads online. And as companies looked at the internet, they were concerned with making it into an advertising medium. And there's the other companies, the ISPs, the companies online, what would become the Googles and the Microsofts and the Apples and the Amazons, all understood that there was a gold mine if you could take the hundreds of billions of dollars spent on advertising and get that in your coffers to provide internet advertising. And over the course of the 90s, and especially in the last decade, we've seen the internet converted into a full-scale advertising medium. But it's revolutionized advertising. And this is something I don't think people fully understand yet, because it's so different than traditional advertising as we've known it from the Mad Men days and until quite recently.
Mm-hmm.
Advertising online is not about placing an ad on a website and then you sort of hope that the people who go to the website see the ad and you live happily ever after. And the website gets paid money and they use the money to provide for the wages to their journalists or their entertainment content producers. Instead, what's happened is advertising online has value the more they know about the person at the computer, not as a class, not as a group, but rather as an individual. So starting in the 90s and now today, it's rampant. The surveillance of every internet user is at the heart of internet advertising, at the heart of what these companies do, collecting unbelievable amounts of data. It's commercially driven. And it's led to what's now called smart advertising. And smart advertising is the future of advertising. Already it's rapidly growing to, I think, $30 or $40 billion this year. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be all of advertising eventually, but it's in the lion's share within a few years. And what that means is if an automobile company wants to place an ad, instead of, like, buying an ad in Sports Illustrated or on ESPN or on a TV show, what it does now is it just goes to one of the big digital networks like Microsoft or Yahoo or AOL and says, I want to reach 30 million men 29 to 34 years old who are in the market to buy cars. And it will just find those men online, whatever website they go to, because they know who you are. They know where you go. They will track you down. And the actual website will only get a pittance of the actual amount. And only those men will see the ad on their computers. No one else will. And what this means is that it requires immense amounts of knowledge about all Americans that these companies have, I mean, the surveillance. And it also means that the content producers online, especially news media, but it's also true of entertainment media, hardly get any money at all through advertising. Advertising has ceased to be a credible means of support for them as it was in the old world of media, which has tremendous implications going forward as well. But for your question, Mark, what this means, too, is that the government, in the United States, which has a huge national security apparatus and which is very keen to know everything it can about people so it can do its job in its view better, has a natural alliance with these commercial interests which have collected all this immense amount of data. And we've seen them working together closely. It's been part of the NSA scandal. And in my research, which predated the Snowden revelations, but pretty much said the same thing Snowden said,
mm-hmm.
Based on the material I had, shows that these companies and the government work hand in hand, always have, and there's a tremendous amount of symmetry between them. It's a marriage of great convenience for both of them, and it's highly troubling by traditional democratic theory.
I mean, you even give examples just in that one point. I do want to come back to advertising and journalism here, but that one point, you even come up with examples of things that we don't even know about on local levels where police and the digital the people who own this digital information, these companies, have cooperated with local police to pinpoint people.
It goes on all the time. I mean, we have the huge scandal. There was a scandal at the time. Now it's passé. When it came out that the phone company, AT&T, and all the phone companies are turning over all their telephone logs to the Bush administration, it became such a scandal that, you know, that the NSA was collecting all this data. The Congress had to pass retroactive immunity for the phone companies,
right,
which I talk about in the book.
Right.
But that stuff's standard now. That has been routine. It's not that was a fluke. That's going on all the time. It's been built right into the system now. It's hardwired, in fact, you could almost say. This data is being collected and shared. It almost doesn't even require a conscious plan. It's the natural order of things.
Did you say order or odor?
I think you could say both. But I think the point here, and I think this pertains to the discussion of the NSA scandal today and the debates about its propriety. There's a big issue here that I conclude the chapter on, but I don't think gets enough attention, which is You know, one doesn't have to be a socialist to be concerned about this. One doesn't have to be a hyper-liberal. In fact, I think if you look at the great conservative economists and thinkers of the last 100 years, Hayek, for example, or Milton Friedman from the University of Chicago, Milton Friedman's argument in defense of capitalism, he said the reason why capitalism is the best system for democracy is that it's the only system that divides control over the economy from control over the government. And so you don't have concentrated power like you do under communism or feudalism, where the same person who owns the country also owns the government. You know, the same person, the richest person is also the king. Now, that's a bad thing, Friedman says, because concentrated power leads to corruption and all sorts of terrible things. So Friedman's argument was the genius of capitalism is it separated political power from economic power. And also, what it did is, in the economic realm, it had competition. So it didn't allow anyone to get too big, to have too much muscle to dominate the economy and therefore have the leverage to take over the government. And what we see going on today in the sort of digital military complex that's emerging is we have extraordinarily large companies working secretly with the government hand in hand, making a mockery of Milton Friedman's defense of capitalism and democracy, just blowing it up like a trick cigar on April Fool's Day. We have, and I don't say this to be pejorative, but it's just to be accurate. We have, in fact, what's one of the classic definitions of fascism, which is very large corporations working hand in hand with a government, which is primarily concerned with surveillance and militarism, and both depending a great deal on propaganda. And that, I hate to say it, is not an inaccurate depiction of what we see in the United States today.
No, I'm afraid it's not. I mean, and the way you kind of conclude the book on those notes of where we could be going, but also talk about what we could do to ideas about how to kind of stop it. But on our way to that place, when you talk about advertising, I was thinking about what you wrote about advertising in the book, and it made a great deal of sense. But there was an article the other week in the New York Times about the Tribune newspapers that are trying to sell off their print editions. They're still trying, but they are investing heavily now in buying local TV stations. They're buying 19 stations around the country, local television stations, which they'd say in terms of advertising are more profitable than anything else. Only the internet comes in a close second at the moment, and then print falling behind. And that, but there's a synergy there between what happens on local TV and what happens on the internet in terms of advertising. And it also seems to me to be something, an argument can be made that, you know, back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when large corporations who ran ran television, network news, network news was there being funded by the rest of the station in many ways. But we've chosen not to do that at all. I mean, am I making too much of a leap here with this?
Well, we're leaping in a couple of different directions. I think.
Yeah, I was. I know, but
at the end there, I think the when network news developed on television in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, initially it was seen as a lost leader, that it was what stations did to justify their getting these monopoly licenses from the government for free. They get monopoly rights to a very lucrative spectrum to broadcast radio and TV signals at no charge from the government. In exchange for that, they're theoretically, legally, supposed to do something they wouldn't do if they were just a commercial enterprise. They're supposed to do something in the public interest. And their journalism tended to be a big part of that. And I think that was, what was the vision they had of it. But then journalism became a source of profits for the commercial stations, and they treated it like a profitable type of programming. But pretty quickly on, when they saw you could make a lot of money at it. I think as for the value of local TV stations, and this relates directly, Mark, to the book you and I have talked about with John Nichols just last week or the week before on the air, mm-hmm. called Dollarocracy, a lot of the reason, and I'm surprised the coverage didn't pick up on this, for why local stations have become very profitable is the growth of TV candidate advertising. This was only 2% of the revenues of local television stations 20 years ago. Last year in 2012, it was, depending on the station, anywhere from 25 to 40% of all revenues came from TV advertising. I mean, it's a huge subsidy of these stations They make enormous amounts of money from it. And I think that's been a crucial factor towards making them much more desirable for people to own.
But I mean, one, I guess the reason I raised that was because I'm thinking about all the space you spent in the book, and important space, talking about the decline of journalism and how it's not caused by but tied to the monopolization of the, our digital world. On the and so I'm trying to compare that to how in local television, that one of the most profitable sectors, one of the most sectors viewed by more people than even CNN, is local news. And so I had kind of tied together in a very kind of strange way here where it's almost as if it's a conscious effort not to have the news done because the money is there on some levels locally.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm following you.
Well, what I'm saying is when you talk about we're destroying the news in America, we've destroyed journalism, political journalism, as you describe it in the book, your analysis of political journalism. And how they're taking the money out of it and not funding it. I mean, but the reality is like that locally, television stations make a lot of money on local news, but consciously decide to keep it dumbed down and not a news of any substance.
That's right. Well, I think they do what's rational business. They sell ads, and they run the least expensive, easiest to do content, which basically means not doing journalism. That means covering... just doing entertainment stuff, just sort of light, frivolous stuff, crime stories, but no real journalism. And I think that's how the market works in this situation. That's what we get. And I think the broader argument I make in the book, and this is where it pertains to that, is that for these companies today, and it's not just broadcasters, but it's also newspaper publishers, anyone who's traditionally done journalism, journalism no longer makes sense commercially. That's why all these companies across the board have discontinued it or they've sloughed off on it. They've dramatically lowered their resources to do it. And, you know, the question I ask in the book, I mean, I posit, first of all, that not having journalism is not consistent with having our constitutional system work. It's predicated on there being an active, aggressive, and viable press system. The Supreme Court has said that. Our founders have said that. I mean, it's not an option. Oh, maybe you can have journalism or maybe you can't. You've got to have it. And if it's disappearing, if commercial interests have said, we can't make money doing it, we're not going to do this anymore, where does that leave us as a society? Now, the celebrants have all said, well, don't worry. The Internet lowers costs so much. Everyone's a journalist now. Everyone's doing journalism. We're going to have a golden age of journalism. So I want to interrogate that. Is that a realistic possibility? And I think the evidence is in. That's absurd. That's not a realistic possibility. Journalism isn't something people can do in their pajamas after they put their kids to bed and clean the house and pay the bills. They sit down at their computer and write about nuclear policy in North Korea or write about a toxic dump meeting at the local zoning board. It requires, you know, newsrooms, people who are competing with editors and fact checkers. It's a complex industrial undertaking to have quality journalism. And it takes people with skill and institutions with the muscle to stand up to powerful forces and to scare them. We're losing all those things online. And in the book, I say, you know, this is a core problem of the Internet as a democratizing agency if it's not only not contributing to journalism, but in fact is participating in making it all but obsolete.
And you also make an argument in the book, which is interesting, that the profit motive in journalism hasn't always been there. That there has been public subsidy at one level or another for a long time, and this is a piece of our history we don't know. And I think that was kind of really illustrative of some important points that most people aren't aware of.
It's really crucial, and I'm glad you raised that point. I mean, the way to understand journalism is it's what economists call a public good. It's something society desperately needs and requires, but that the market, the profit motive, cannot provide in sufficient quality or quantity, much like education or military spending. It's the classic public good. And the reason why that has been hidden to Americans until now, until quite recently, is that for the last 100 or 125 years, advertising provided the vast majority of the revenues to pay for journalism. And so it had all this commercial support, so it looked like, you know, journalism was a highly lucrative commercial undertaking with all this ad money and all the fortunes being made. But that was deceptive because advertisers only supported news media for opportunistic reasons. And now that they have better options online with the smart advertising, they've jumped ship en masse. And the money's gone. And we can see now that, again, journalism is a public good. Final readers, final users have never provided 100% of the revenue for a broad-based popular journalism, and they never will. And this leads, and I think this is what you're getting at, Mark, to the obvious question is, well, if advertising only came in the last 100, 125 years to support journalism, how the heck did we have a free press in the first 100 years of American history? During an era that many consider our most vibrant democracy, especially in the northern United States, with high voter turnout and public involvement. And the reason is that our journalism, and this is sort of the great secret that's not widely distributed, disseminated, our journalism in the United States for the first 100 years of American history was heavily subsidized by the federal government through massive postal subsidies and printing subsidies. That if we had similar subsidies as a percentage of the gross domestic product today, the federal government has to be spending along the lines of $35 billion supporting newspapers and magazines and journalists. It was a huge subsidy, and it was consciously done. I mean, it was debated heavily by the framers, Jefferson and Madison, Washington, Hamilton, all debated it. They understood that if you're going to have self-government, you needed a broad press, and the market would not generate anything close to a sufficient press. Left just to the profit motive, you'd have journalism for elites and property owners, but the rest of the population would be out of luck. That's why they put in these postal subsidies, which basically made the distribution of newspapers free. So they took the entire cost of distribution out of the hands of a publisher. So it made it a lot easier for people to start publishing newspapers, and that cost wasn't going to be a factor. So that's our real history. And the framers of this country understood it was a social commitment of the highest order to create institutions of journalism. And I think we've got to look at that chapter in American history again and think again about what we can do to make sure we have independent, uncensored, competing news that really works. One of the ways this is done traditionally around the world is through public radio and television, community radio and television. And most other countries, especially stronger democracies in the United States, tend to have much stronger public systems. It's always been a weak spot in the United States, and I've written about that at length at other places. But we have to be thinking in those sort of terms if we're going to solve this problem, and I think we better think about solving it because I don't know where we're going to be otherwise.
And the reason I raised the issue at this point is I want to talk about that very issue of how to solve this problem, because I think that what you just raised about our history is something we really do not know. I mean, I'm glad it's in your book, but people don't realize that history, and I keep being reminded of Orwell's statement that he who controls the present controls the past, and he who controls the past controls the future. You know? And it's true, and I think that this, we don't understand what could be done. And part of what you're trying to argue here, and let's talk a bit about that, is arguing about what you think could be done, what citizens can do, what we can do to initiate a fight to keep our democracy alive and to change the nature of how our digital world is controlled by everybody but us.
Well, I think there's so many levels that has to be done, but starting specifically with journalism, you know, it's funny, when the collapse of journalism really became recognized about 5 years ago, both the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission launched formal studies of the crisis and what could be done by the government to arrest the decline. And to give some sense of the decline, because listeners might not be fully aware of this, there are probably about 40% as much resources being spent on journalism today for reporters and reporting as there were 25 years ago. I mean, it's just a free fall of disintegration of editorial coverage of government, of politics, of policies. I chronicle it in the book. If someone pays careful attention or they're working journalists, they're well aware of this because they've seen newsrooms look like, you know, Gettysburg the day after the war, you know, rather than bustling places of enterprising workers. And, you know, the crisis is severe, and we have to come up with some sort of solutions. The commercial interests have jumped ship. You know, I think what I propose in the book, and I think where the debate ought to be centering, is Dean Baker, the great economist, lives in Washington, who's done a lot of work on Social Security. He came up with a plan 10, 12 years ago that every American would be entitled to donate $100 or $200 to any nonprofit medium of their choice. out of federal money, out of government money. So it's a public subsidy, but the government wouldn't control who gets it. And I developed that plan to serve as a way to fund a whole generation of nonprofit, non-commercial competing media, independent media. I'm not saying that's the perfect plan. I'm not saying we couldn't do better, but we've got to start thinking like that if we want to have journalism. And what was striking to me when the FCC and FTC launched those formal inquiries, I actually met with both of them and read my last book that I wrote with John Nichols called Death of Life in American Journalism. And they both said, you know, we agree with you. You're right. You've nailed it here. The books were dog-eared. They were so marked up. But then they both basically said, but politically, we can't touch this. It's too sensitive. The idea that you would say that you need to have public subsidies, even if it's completely set up such a way that there'd be no government involvement, that's just not going to fly, even though we understand that rationally, scientifically, that's the only plausible solution.
I mean, otherwise, we end up with even in public media, where you have the campaign now to stop the Koch brothers from dictating to PBS what they can do, or the fact that they have to rely on Archer Daniel Midland's to do all the reporting.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have public media in the in the Norwegian sense, or the Swedish or German sense, or the Japanese sense. We have a completely emaciated and underfunded system that relies on desperate begging. It's a very different history in America. We wouldn't even know what to do if we had genuine public media. And I do think we need, and I use the term media, not broadcasting, because, it's the institution.
Right.
Having people who do the work, the means of transmission, be it a computer, a smartphone, or television, or radio, is secondary. We need that sort of commitment of resources that's lacking here. And on that note, I point this out in the book, if you look at the countries that The Economist magazine, which is, it's a fairly conservative business publication, they rank every year in a democracy index all the countries in the world and how democratic they are. And if you look at their top 10 countries year in and year out, as we do in the book, you find that the countries that are at the top, the most democratic countries in the world, according to The Economist, are all the countries that spend the very most subsidizing public media and journalism: Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany. If we spent on a per capita basis what those countries spend on public media and journalism, we would be spending $30, $35 billion a year, like Denmark or Norway or Germany. And, it's striking. That's the same figure we used to spend in the 19th century. Maybe that's the democratic figure for a country like this, is $30, $35 billion. We hardly spend anything as it is, just a few hundred million, really. In fact, we spend more on overseas propaganda than we do on our domestic journalism and communication. So we've got a long way to go here. The discussion has really not gotten anywhere. All we have now are newsrooms that people walk around like they're in a zombie planet because they're dying so quickly, and everyone's so depressed and they don't see a future. The Internet idea of coming up with a digital journalism just hasn't panned out. It's been nothing short of a complete fiasco, and I think that's sort of dawning on people now that there's no solution there either. These are deeply troubling times, and this is a problem that we cannot, it's not going to solve itself. We have to address politically.
And I think that's what we have to do. We have to keep these discussions up and push on these issues. And I deeply appreciate the book you've written. I really encourage everyone to pick it up. It is a battle cry for what we can do and what we need to understand is going on around us. Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy, by Robert W. McChesney. All the links will be on our website at steinershow.org. And Bob McChesney, thanks so much for the book and spending so much time with our listeners.
Absolute pleasure, Mark. Let's do it again.
Thank you. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.